So I have the challenging task of bringing up the rear and trying to make up a little bit of time so that we can have time for discussion. So I'm going to go through a few slides about what we're doing in Massachusetts, and particularly in the community health center realm. So as I said before, I'm a community health center pediatrician, and I was treating obesity in kind of the usual care model where I was trying to see my own patients back, and I was booking 4 patients an hour and getting really, really frustrated. I'd sometimes have the help of my nutritionist where I'd refer the patients, and the patients invariably wouldn't show up to that nutritionist. And I felt like our care was really uncoordinated and really inefficient from the patient's standpoint. So I actually went at it in a different way, and we'll talk about that. So why start with a clinical obesity intervention? I think Tori's story is one that resonates really well with me. First of all, I'm a clinician, so that seemed like an obvious place to start. But although we know that broad public health interventions are important to reduce the incidence of obesity, but they may not be enough for kids who are already obese. So that speaks to what Tori was saying about where in the continuum of obesity do you target people. So certainly, there's a huge need for primary prevention of obesity. As we know, the prevalence is really high. But there are a bunch of kids out there who are already overweight or obese, and something has to be done about those kids as well before they progress onto further morbidities of obesity. Many underserved kids still have decreased access to open play spaces and healthy foods, despite numerous efforts from federal, state, and local governments to improve access. So we need to have some interventions within our current infrastructure while we build the rest of that infrastructure that's so essential to 20 years from now. There are expert committee recommendations for obesity treatment, which recommend monthly primary care follow-up for children who are already overweight with risk factors or obese. These are the prevention plus and structured weight management protocols for those of you who are familiar. And these protocols recommend regular obesity follow-up from a skilled primary care team. And this, again, speaks to my experience as a primary care clinician in that this is not that easy to do. Oops, sorry. So the current challenges to the expert committee recommendations. Many pediatric teams do not have the training in obesity or motivational interviewing. And frankly, many don't have the interest in treating obesity, right? It's a very social disease. It's a very complex disease. It's not as easy as something like ADHD. Not that that's always easy to treat, but there's a medicine out there. And as I was speaking, when we were talking about what we were hopeful for, you know, my mentors have told me to pick a disease with a medicine because then I can show impact, right? So for that, those same reasons, many people don't want to treat it on the front lines. Dietitians and mental health providers are not typically available in the primary care setting, so some of the expert recommendations incorporate other team members, and those are really hard to operationalize, particularly in small practices. Primary care visits are brief, making it difficult to engage families in health behavior change, so just understanding what a family eats probably takes a good 15 minutes, and if you're blowing in and out of rooms at 4 an hour, it really just doesn't work for the clinician or for the patient. Multidisciplinary care, again, is not the norm in the pediatrician's office, and many pediatricians just don't know how to operationalize the guidelines. They have this rich set of guidelines that seem to require more of them, like many guidelines out there, than they're possibly able to provide in these really brief visits, and they're just kind of stuck. And there's actually survey data and other data to support that. So as a result of that, many children who are recommended for primary care treatment are referred to hospital obesity clinics. And I'm from Boston. We have, I think, 4 hospital obesity clinics at 4 different children's hospitals because we're Boston. That's much less true for other places in the country. But even where I am, capacity is limited, and so the wait times are really long. So when I started doing this work, my severely obese kids I would refer out to one of the hospital-based clinics. And the wait times were typically 3 to 4 months, and the kid would continue to get fatter, and the parents would be more frustrated. You know, the BMI would keep increasing. And then by the time they got there, they had sort of lost their motivation. And then hospital treatment can be more expensive. The clinics around Boston are generally largely federally funded or funded by big foundations. So sometimes they include an exercise physiologist, and they include a PhD in behavioral change. And so all those things are great resources to have, but are really difficult to replicate for all the kids out there who need this kind of treatment. And then care is fragmented by providing obesity treatment outside of the medical home. So, you know, patients that I sent to these hospital clinics would invariably not show up. You know, about half of them wouldn't show up, even more. And I'd ask them when they came back to see me, what happened? And they'd say, I couldn't find a parking spot. You know, I didn't know the system. I didn't know anyone there. They didn't understand my language or my culture. And so they really felt like it was a disservice to them to see a whole new provider for something that was so integral to their lifestyle. Oops, sorry, I keep doing this. Okay. So just a little bit about community health centers, because that's the space in which our initiative works. So community health centers are located in urban and rural high-need communities. They're primary care medical homes for poor and underinsured children, and there are over 1,200 of them in 50 states. And obviously, there's been a lot of federal funding recently to expand that capacity. Right now, they provide primary care to 20 million Americans, 70% of whom live in poverty. And they often have ancillary providers such as dietitians and behavioral health providers because they're a multi-specialty model in most scenarios. And then just some basic principles of a patient-centered medical home. I think that this movement is taking more and more shape as time goes on. So what it endorses is team-based care led by a physician, continuity and coordination of care over time, patient care that's culturally and linguistically appropriate, and support of high-quality care through information technology. And for those of us who do anything on the front lines, all of these are obvious points of good quality care, but the fact that this is coming out in an evidence-based way, and there's been a recent initiative to transform a large number of health centers into true patient-centered medical homes, means that this movement is going to sort of bring us along on all of these points as well as others. Oh, wait. Okay, sorry. So our current collaborative sites. No. Obviously, I talk about technology, which I'll talk a little bit more about, and I can't work the mouse, so it's great. So our current collaborative sites are 8 community health centers in Massachusetts. They're both urban and rural. So we have sites in Boston, and we have sites on the Outer Cape and out in Holyoke, Massachusetts. And the provider champions are pediatricians, family practitioners, and I think we have one nurse practitioner at this point. The pediatric panels ranging in these health centers range from under 2,000 to over 15,000 children. It started at the Whittier Street Health Center, which is where I work, in 2006, and we started from our operating clinic budget. So when we started, I just got the administration to agree to putting myself and the nutritionist, making us both available to obese patients during the same clinic session. And if I didn't fill my obesity clinic, I had to see the rest of my patients. And so it was really challenging at the very beginning. And then as the clinic gained traction, I was able to advocate for a case manager and really have a true multidisciplinary model. We selected our other partners using a request for proposals process. So I think that that's a really great way to select sites. We had tried to reach out to some partners of the foundation I worked with and had a lot of difficulty getting people who were really interested in doing exactly what we wanted to do. So we did an RFP in 2008, and we selected the three sites you see there, and then in 2009, we selected another 4 sites. So our collaborative structure and technical assistance, we do site visits, one at initiation, and then on demand thereafter. We do semi-annual live meetings, which are the most valuable piece of the collaborative infrastructure. I think face-to-face meetings, Amanda spoke about kind of the e-meetings, and we do a lot of that, but having people get in the room at least once and introduce themselves to each other really allows for better collaboration going forward. Our meetings are centered around best practice review, training about motivational interviewing, so we train every member of the team in motivational interviewing or health behavior change. We do operations troubleshooting and quality improvement and data review. And then monthly conference calls, best practice review, data quality review, expert speakers, and then updates between the live meetings. And those are completely remote meetings. We use something like GoToMeeting, and we do slides remotely for all of the teams. And then we use an email and blog, which are primarily used to share best practices and changes in obesity-related policy. And then we have a centralized technical assistance team, of which I'm the medical director, and we provide support for these interactions, including on-demand virtual assistance and expert advice for the clinics. And then we do a lot of peer mentoring. So when we started this initiative 2.5 years ago, we did all the talking. You know, we'd have our live meetings, and it would be 3 hours of the motivational interviewing trainer and typically 3 hours of me. So you can imagine how that got old really fast for the entire group. So over time, we've really tried to pull back and have the clinics talk more to each other. And we have a meeting next week, and it's still a couple hours of the motivational interviewing, but that is more patient-centered, and it's more the clinics bringing their own cases. And then the afternoon is really about the clinics talking about their challenges and opportunities, where I will only participate as a member of one specific clinic. So it's really been a phenomenal change over time. So just to go into the model in more detail, what we operate on is a specialized primary care, a secondary care model. So in this model, basically, my partners refer to me. So anyone who sees a kid who's overweight or obese at a well visit or at any other time where this issue comes up will refer someone to me within the health center. The primary care team is trained as experts. So as I said, we do quality improvement training, obesity best practices training, and health behavior change training for all the members of every team. The children are aged 3 to 21 with a BMI greater than the 85th percentile. So I think that this is an important reason of why we're successful. We take a very broad age range, and we take kids who are not that obese. And so when Tori was talking about, you know, just true prevention, I think we'll probably fall into secondary prevention. So these are kids who are at risk for further morbidity. But because we're not seeing what the hospital clinics are seeing, which are kids who are way beyond the 99th percentile for BMI, we're much more able to affect change because we're in the earlier stages. We have monthly visits tailored to each family. Ideally, 6 visits over 6 months is the intervention. But again, our primary goal is to deliver services. So although we'll talk a little bit about the evaluation, our goal is to see people whenever they're ready. So I've had patients, some of my best performers, if you will, now, are kids who were in my clinic 4 years ago, came once or twice, were not really ready to make any changes in their lifestyle, and then kind of dropped out of the clinic for a couple of years and came back in, and now are really ready to go. So they knew we were there, we're sustainable, we're there over time, we're within their health center, so it's a very low bar to re-enroll, and I think that that's been a huge part of our success over time. So just to go over exactly what we do, we operate on team-based care. So we reorganize care. The provider, the nutritionist, and the case manager are all accessible to the family at the same time. So it's increased efficiency, but you can imagine. What we do is we basically run 3 rooms, and the patients stay in one place, and we move around among the rooms. And so, you know, for the patient, it's sort of a more cohesive visit. We use our data collection form that's either electronic or paper-based, basically the medical record, to communicate with each other. So we pick up where the other one left off and are able to communicate fairly seamlessly with the families. The no-show rate is far decreased over the individual visits. The visits that I did for obesity had a reasonable show rate because it was a doctor's appointment, but the nutritionist visits had terrible, terrible show rates, and that's improved significantly with this model. And then each provider addresses their own area of expertise. So the provider champion really does cardiovascular risk assessment, family history review, lab analysis, physical exam, and billing. But really what I say is that I do the least of the work in my clinic, right? I'm there basically to bless, so everyone wants to hear that the doctor thinks they're doing a good job, and to bill. And that's really a big part of the sustainability of the model, but most of the work is done by the other two members of my team, who are both fantastic. So the nutritionist, in all of our sites, it's a registered dietitian, but we haven't mandated that as an initiative. They do a brief 24-hour food recall. They look at skip meals, sweetened beverages, and fruit and vegetable consumption. And in Massachusetts, for Medicaid, they can actually also bill separately on the same day. That varies from state to state, and it varies by payer, but that is a possibility. The case manager does activity assessment and in connection with local activity resources. So people always ask me who the case manager is. In most of our sites, it's actually a medical assistant that's come to some of these meetings and gotten a little bit of extra training. But it's really not someone who's very highly skilled in case management. It's someone who's pretty readily available in most clinical settings because it was very important to us to have a model that was replicable in a variety of settings. So all of us do a little bit of motivational interviewing or health behavior change techniques. And, you know, the average visit is about 40 minutes to an hour for all 3 providers. So you can imagine we don't do true motivational interviewing for those of you who are really familiar with it. What we do is kind of somewhere between a brief negotiated interview and some brief health behavior change practices. So we use things like a stage of change ruler or a menu of options so people can kind of select their self-management goals. And we focus on 2 to 3 patient-generated goals per month. So integration of health information technology, I'll go through this briefly. we have a standardized data collection form in the paper and the electronic health record formats, which I'll show you on the next slide, includes the key indicators. And as Tori said, we just, most of what we collect is demographics, 5, 2, 1, and 0, because those are kind of nationally recognized and evidence-based. And really, when we started out, we had a very complex data intake form. I had really wanted to catch every piece of data that I could on all these patients. It's a great longitudinal sample. But what we found was that people were missing the forest for the trees. They were not necessarily recording BMI, but maybe recording, you know, whether or not the patient had acanthosis nigricans, for example. And ultimately, what's more important is the really basic stuff. And so we've changed our data system and really have this stuff only in it. It's a clinical tool used in real time by the clinic staff. I think that that's really important. So the electronic health record form is embedded in the EHR at my site. And the people who don't have an electronic health record use a paper version of it. We built a paper version. And so they kind of fill it out like you would an EHR. So it's kind of a templated form in the same way. So it drives care during healthy weight clinic visits by prompting the team to use best practices. So you can imagine it's harder to forget about asking about fruits and vegetables if it's clearly listed on the page how many fruits and vegetables do they take in an average day. For the electronic health record version, there are comparisons of previous results with current results. So you can look at what their last BMI was and their new BMI is, and then you can look at a change. And that's really, really helpful to take a quick snapshot and know where the kid is going. It's clinical data collection, and then there's communication within the team during clinic visits, as I spoke about. We use that as a method of communication. And this is the basis for our web-based data collection system. We had hoped to integrate our data collection system with the various electronic health records that we use throughout our initiative. It's so costly and so consuming in terms of IT manpower or woman power that it ended up being not worth it. It was something that we felt really strongly about at the outset and still have not secured the resources to do, and we're pretty far in. But so because of this, we have a parallel system. It's a web-based data collection system that's fully encrypted. De-identified data is entered monthly at a minimum after every clinic at optimum. And I think most of our clinics enter data every week, so it's great. You can go into the system on Monday, and there are X number of patients, and you can go into the system on Friday, and there's a different number of patients. It's a HIPAA-compliant SQL database, for those of you who are that interested in the technology. And it's used to generate run charts and quality reporting, which we review with all the teams. And we review them every quarter with all the clinic sites. And they're really into the data, and they're really into trying to figure out how to make their make best practices work better at their own sites or figure out why there's a gap. And it's been a really engaging process. So this is what the tool looks like. If you look at, you can see sort of, if you look at the top, there's height, weight, and weight change, and there's BMI, and that tells you where the last one was entered, but if you entered another one, you'd see them side by side, and you'd see the change. There are fields for stage of change, so you look at the patient goals, and then the stage of change. There are also parent goals, depending on the age of the child. So just a brief breakdown of who we see. You know, we're about 53% female, 47% male. 36% of our patients identify as non-Hispanic, and Hispanic, I guess, are the rest, 64%. 39% white, 3% American Indian, 2% Asian, and 56% black. And then in terms of our insurance status, 77% are publicly insured. So that's probably pretty reflective of all the health centers together. We don't have great data from all of the health centers that we can combine to look at what the draw population is, but based on what they tell us, this is pretty similar to what they see as a whole. So just to look at our age distribution, as you can see, our youngest child is 3, our oldest child is 22, so I guess maybe not a child at all. And the critical mass is somewhere in between. And all of our sites do it a little bit differently in terms of who they draw. The clinic is open from 3 to 21-year-olds. I think in the smaller sites, they open it up to the whole group. In the larger sites, they've really had to cut down the population. And so some of those sites have said, okay, you can only do 8 to 12-year-olds at this time until we can have more resources to start another clinic for other kids. So that is a little bit challenging with our data. In the total number of visits for patients who have come back, so there are 402 patients right now in the system who have been to the clinic more than once. There's a huge drop-off after the first visit for a variety of reasons. I mean, this is predominantly an underserved population, and we're trying to get them to think preventatively about their weight. And so there are, as you all know, really difficult problems within that. But despite that, 153 of our patients have been seen twice. And as you see, the numbers sort of drop off and stabilize, but some of our kids have been seen for more than 7 visits. And we've never mandated that people stop seeing. Some of our clinics do graduation and try to stop it, but you know, for my patients who I've seen for 6 visits, sometimes they do great for a while, and I say, look, like, when I talk to them, I say, I have nothing else to tell you. You know, you can recite 5210 to me. You can tell me what I should be doing that I'm not doing. So at this point, I think it's fair to kick you out. Some of them don't want to be kicked out. They just flat out say, no, this clinic motivates me, and I want to keep coming back, and I feel like my responsibility as their primary care provider is to say that's fine. And others say, great, I'm out, and then they come back in 6 months later and say they're having a really hard time. So, you know, their life has changed a little bit. Typically, it's around the age where kids become more independent, you know. So someone who was typically having all their food choices made by their parents, who's now transitioning to more independence, who's having trouble making the right choices on their own. So we open it up and we kind of let them. The highest number that we have recorded was 11 visits, which is almost twice as many as we recommend. So the data for the patients with more than one visit. So if you look at the BMI, it's about 45% of our patients have a decrease in BMI from their first visit to their last, and about another 20% that maintain the same BMI from their first to the last visit. So I think, you know, in terms of our results, we've seen great results. You can look at the rest of it. We've had less success with sweetened beverages, better with fruits and vegetables, and in the middle with physical activity. Fruits and vegetables is something that's been particularly hard to address in this setting, so we're going to actually, I'll show you, there's another program we've added on to do a better job with that. Because a lot of our patients live in food deserts, it tends to be very difficult. So we think that a lot of our early success has really been related to the fact that we see patients early, that we see them often, and that we're really accessible to them. So self-management goals, just 97% of our visits include a self-management goal. And I think that that's a huge improvement over what I was doing by myself in an obesity clinic. So key elements of success have been case management to improve the show rate. The case managers do reminder calls and sometimes recruitment letters. A consistent physician-led team. We've actually had a little bit more success with physician-led teams than we have with teams that were run by ancillary providers. I'm not sure of why that is, and it wasn't certainly my a priori hypothesis that we would want only doctors to run the teams, but there seems to be something about the team dynamic that works a little bit better with physicians. But you know, we would like to see more teams and really flesh that out a little bit better. Effective team training, both within and outside of the collaborative infrastructure, to build expertise. So some of our clinics have gone to other obesity conferences or gotten other MI training or things like that, and that's augmented the work that we do. Increasing attention to obesity in the media has increased awareness of family and then the request for referrals. So, you know, we do the best when our referrals are patient-driven, when the patient goes into their primary care doctor. And, you know, we have posters up in the waiting rooms and in a lot of the exam rooms, and they say to their doctor, I want to be part of this. How do I help my kid? That's done better for us over time. Marketing both within and outside of community health centers, so schools, community health centers, local media, and then integration with other community programs. And I'll just speak briefly about our public health partnerships that are initiative-wide. So the goal of our partnerships is to improve the outcomes and remove barriers to a healthy lifestyle. So we're not really looking to provide incentives in the classic sense. What we're looking for is to level the playing field a little bit. So where we can make recommendations to families who are middle or upper class and expect those recommendations to be carried out, often in the space where I work, it's not that easy. So we focus on increasing consumption of healthy food and increasing physical activity. There are local partnerships at each health center, so many work with the YMCA or other youth organizations. Many host clinic-based cooking classes, farmers market field trips at one site, and then the health centers run youth programming. So I run an after-school program that's focused on healthy lifestyles as another arm to this intervention, because often when I meet with families, they say, there's nothing that I can go to that's free. So we've opted to obtain grant funding to provide a free program after school that we can open up to our families. So our collaborative wide partnerships, there are a few. So we partner with a foundation called Good Sports, which gives out free exercise equipment, including clothes and sneakers. So one of the big things we saw in our after school program was that, you know, particularly girls were coming in wearing jeweled flip-flops to play basketball. And, you know, I mean, if you're wearing flip-flops that are high heels particularly, you're really not going to run that fast. So, you know, this is a huge problem. And when you're asked, you know, they've prioritized, they can afford to buy one set of shoes per season, and they've prioritized sort of the more fashionable pair of shoes rather than the more utilitarian. I would do the same thing, so I understand that completely. But it causes a really big problem. So now we're able to provide them with sneakers and say, okay, now you can actually run during this program. Paul Pierce, for those of you who don't know, he's a Celtics captain. So a basketball player, for those of you who don't know who the Celtics are, which was me once, so don't worry about it. So he has a Truth on Health Fund, and with that they've developed activity watches that are kind of motion-based, and they encourage 60 minutes of activity daily. And you can log into his website and get encouragement from Paul that feels very personal, and he appears at some of our clinic sites and kind of tries to work with the kids more directly, so that's been a huge inspiration for a lot of the kids that we serve. And then the next thing I'll talk about is our fruit and vegetable prescription program, which is a partnership with the Wholesome Wave Foundation to improve access to fresh produce. So, as I said, we had a lot of trouble impacting fruits and vegetables. What we found was, you know, in three or four visits, we could put people with activity programs, we could even see some impact on weight. Sweetened beverages, there was some difficulty, but it was able to be amenable over time. And fruits and vegetables, we'd see kids on the fifth or sixth visit, and they'd still be getting, like, one fruit or vegetable a day, and when you asked what it was often like a fruit roll snack or something that someone like me would not classify as a fruit or vegetable. So our fruit and vegetable prescription program was designed to address this, and we've been looking for a long time to the right solution to really help people gain access. I know that there is a lot of work underway about, you know, economic development in these areas and bringing in bigger stores. Those are longer term goals. Like, we needed to do something 2 years ago, so we really needed to do something now. So it's a collaboration between a community health foundation and a foundation dedicated to improving access to farm fresh foods for low-income families. We did a pilot this year with 3 healthy weight clinic health centers and 50 families. Their vouchers are for fruit and vegetable purchase only at a network of over 200 Massachusetts farmers markets. So the vouchers, they look like checks. They're serially numbered. We can track redemption, and they bring them into the farmers market, and they get, you know, $2.50 per coupon of fruits and vegetables. The goal of the program is to increase the intake by one serving per household member per day, and it works out to be $112 monthly for a family of 4 during the 4-month season. And the vouchers are issued at healthy weight clinic visits and are associated with stage of change assessment and health behavior change messaging. We feel like this is really important, that the messaging and the health behavior change strategy be tied into giving the distribution of the coupons, so that, you know, families will act on our recommendations and see this as a vessel to act on our recommendations. So just briefly, future directions. Expansion, development of a low-touch technical assistance model. Right now, we're pretty high-touch, as you probably gathered from the slides. When people ask us for help, we give it. When people ask us to come out and look at something, we do. And I think that the goal, as we want to get bigger, is to pull back a little bit over time. Expansion to additional sites without seed funding. So the first 8 sites we funded got $20,000 in the first year, $10,000 in the second, and $5,000 in the third, because we really had no proof that our model would work. All we had was the data from my site, and the criticism was often, well, you believe in this program, and you know, you started this program, so of course it works for you, but who says it's going to work for anyone else? So we did kind of put out carrots. And then further expansion of the fruit and vegetable program in conjunction with the Healthy Weight Clinic. So really trying to roll those out together as a combined model. In terms of evaluation, we're currently analyzing the first 2 years of collaborative activity, and we're doing financial analysis of the revenue generated by the clinic, the comparison of this cost of this model to other models. All of our clinics have reported that they're either financially neutral or they're actually making money, so this is a financially sustainable model once we step out of the picture. It is not as lucrative as another clinic, so it's important to note that if you see 5 or 6 sick visits, the clinic will generate more revenue than it will with a healthy weight clinic visit, because you have to pay for the case manager and for the nutritionist, depending on the way your payer system works. But it is still completely neutral, so if the health center has the mission to do this, they can. We're looking at a controlled time series study to determine the true effect of the intervention. So we're trying to compare to a large database of underserved children in Boston, because my hypothesis is that even our kids who don't lose weight actually gain weight at a lower rate than than normal kids, or, you know, kids that aren't in the intervention. So that's our next step, and we'll be doing that this winter. And then we're looking to secure resources to conduct an RCT of fruit and vegetable over the next year, and the Healthy Weight Clinic in 1 to 2 years after that. And then for program partnerships, we're looking to locate partners for physical activity partnerships throughout our reach, so a national organization potentially like the Y or Boys and Girls Clubs. And we're looking for a fresh produce resource for the winter season, like year-round farmers markets potentially, because in Boston the season is only 4 months long, or CSAs. You know, we've talked about grocery stores or frozen foods, but we feel like that might deviate from what we're really hoping to get, which is teaching families how to prepare true local fresh produce. And so that's all I have for slides. We're nearly out of time, but we'd love to hear your thoughts and your discussion. I think our hope as a panel had been to get everyone involved as much as possible and to hear your thoughts. Great, go ahead.
Organic food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes or no? What's the question?
I have not heard anything about organic farming.
Yep, so... In Massachusetts, most of the farmers markets contain a mix of organic and non-organic farmers. We don't dictate whether or not the produce purchase has to be organic, largely because the cost differential is very high in Massachusetts. I think it's high all over the country. So it ends up being a choice of whether or not the families can afford, you know, would like to afford more versus would like to afford organic. So we feel like at least just starting with, you know, a whole tomato versus a can of tomatoes is a great place to begin. Yes? You're talking about in terms of the farmers markets? Who's them?
When you give out vouchers for the farmers markets, do you have to purchase those vouchers? Like, do you give money to them?
We do. So there's a collaboration. There's an association called the Massachusetts Federation of Farmers Markets, and they run those 200 farmers markets and provide technical assistance. They don't run every one, but they provide technical assistance for each one. So the money goes to MassFed. MassFed actually creates the vouchers. The vouchers are serially numbered and distributed to the clinics, so we know which vouchers are associated with which clinics, and then they're redeemed. So the farm market managers actually take the stack of coupons that they have at the end of each week, potentially, or each month. I'm told that farmers like to work more on a monthly basis than a weekly basis. I'm not an expert in that at all. And then they bring them back to MassFed. They get their money back.
On that note, though, I'm sure in Maine and other states are actually doing SNAP. So folks who had the SNAP Ed, not the food stamps, can go to farmers markets. And that's a fantastic program for anybody who is doing that in their state. It's great. In Maine, it's been a huge boon. And there are many farmers markets that are now, even in Maine, that are going through the winter. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The local farmers are having a tough time keeping up with the supply of that.
And one of the secondary goals is to promote the farmers markets in these underserved areas and keep them going year-round, you know, show benefit to a longer season, you know, increase the population that draws from them. So I think that's really important. And also, a lot of places do double value coupons.
Yep.
So if you come in with WIC or SNAP benefits, you can actually get 2 for 1 at a farmers market. So there's an advantage to the families. And that's growing.